information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight, we care.
Appear to border
and it shows.
The law.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
Episode 108 of Media Monarchy, do solemnly swear that I will faithfully investigate the President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, observe, dissect, and offend the rise of Barack Hussein Obama and the fall of Sam Adams, the scandalized mayor of Portland, Oregon. We're here. We've made it relatively unscathed, my friends, through all the presidential bread and circus. We're here at episode 108, January 23rd, 2009. Change has come to America, and we'll just see about that. January 23rd, 2009, episode 108 of MediaMonarchy.com.
We don't need no good reason for the function of our meeting here tonight. Call the law, call it treason. We're beyond realms of believing wrong or right. So I don't know what you voted for. So I don't know, but I know one thing that's for sure. I got this book I've been reading. Got me thinking 'tis the season of a song. Hey. 'Cause we're the government. Oh, oh, oh. We're the law. 'Cause we're the government. Yes, we are. Citizens, we declare declaratives and deny the official. Based in the landmark of the G-spot, we have overtaken ourselves and overthrown our forefathers. Let there be light within the light, and an answer to the name of darkness. We are forever risen from the deadly, the antivirus and the all-stars, granted power by forces unbeknownst to us. Made in the likeness of kindness, we offer anger to the angry and fear to the fearful. We dance at our own funeral to forsake the mourners. This is no time to cry. This is no time at all. Here is the moment of the overlooked and the unforeseeable. We are the elected officials of the people, poets and artists. We are the declarative statement of the inarticulate, the irreparably damaged goods of the bad, meaning good. We are the government. We are the government. We are the government. Let's win the government. Yes, we are. Yeah, we're the government. We're the law. Let's win the government. Yes, we are.
External revenue,
external revenue,
external revenue.
Now tell me, Reverend, who should we be praying to? Inside of me and you.
Inside of me and you.
Now does that ring is true? Or should I look up, up, up and away? Now is it true to say?
Is it true to say
that right here today?
Right here today.
Oh, we can change our way.
Change our way.
Oh, we can change our way. government. Yes, we are. Yes, we are. Hey, we're the government. We're the law. So we're the government. We're the government.
The government. We are the government. That's brand new music. You heard it here first from Saul Williams. SaulWilliams.com. He uploaded that track, The Government, on, of course, Inauguration Day on January 20th, 2009. I've been a longtime fan of Saul Williams. Seen him live. Have all his records. But sometime early last year, the amount of Obama Kool-Aid he started to drink really left a bad taste in my mouth, and I kind of turned off from him. However, I gotta give credit where credit is due. That track is killer, and Saul Williams is an amazing artist. It was just all his bloviating last spring about Obama. Of course, after all, the Democrats fell into line and got behind the Obama-siah. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome to episode 108 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 23rd, 2009. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. The single obsessed person behind MediaMonarchy.com. Blasting out to you originally, live, as always, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, thanks to the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. Now, for the last several weeks, Revere Radio has been carrying Media Monarchy for a long time, back since, I believe, episode 20. And I love them and thank them. They were replaying the episode for the last couple years. As of the last couple of weeks, we're live on revereradionetwork.com, revereradio.net, and of course, it's 1 p.m. on the East Coast. KBFR 93.9 in Boulder, Colorado, blasts out MediaMonarchy.com, and I thank them as well. And of course, I always implore you to hit me up on Facebook or MySpace or YouTube or Yahoo. I am with Media Monarchy as your keyword. Signed in right now. Sometimes my internet connections are sketchy when I'm doing the show live here. You never know what kind of wireless signal you're going to be able to grab or not. But right now, I'm signed in, so maybe hit me up with a comment. It may be distracting. We'll see. Whew. We're here. I never thought all this shit would end. But of course it doesn't end. This was just the end of the beginning. And we have much to go over and dissect with the coronation of Obama. But we got to set the table. And we're going to have to look back a little bit. So hopefully, but probably not the last time, we're going to look back at the criminal Bush regime. Another one that I love to hate to love, much like Saul Williams and some of the other folks out there, but like Keith Olbermann, he does it right sometimes and you gotta give it to him. Brace yourself. 8 years in 8 minutes.
George Walker Bush, 43rd president of the United States, first ever with a criminal record. Our third story tonight, his presidency, 8 years in 8 minutes. Early in 2001, the U.S. fingered al-Qaeda for the bombing of the USS Cole. Bush counterterrorism advisor Richard Clark had a plan to take down al-Qaeda. Instead, by February, the NSC had already discussed invading Iraq and had a plan for post-Saddam Iraq. By March 5th, Bush had a map ready for Iraqi oil exploration and a list of companies. Al-Qaeda? Rice told Clark not to give Bush a lot of long memos, not a big reader. August 6th, 2001, a CIA analyst briefs Bush on vacation. Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S. Bush takes no action, tells briefer, quote, all right, you covered your ass now. Next month, Clark requests using new Predator drones to kill Bin Laden. The Pentagon and CIA say no. September 11th, Bush remains seated for several minutes to avoid scaring school children by getting up and leaving. He then flies around the country and promises, quote, a full-scale investigation to find those folks who did it. Rumsfeld says Afghanistan does not have enough targets. We've got to do Iraq. When the CIA traps Bin Laden at Tora Bora, it asks for 800 Rangers to cut off his escape. Bush outsources the job to Pakistanis sympathetic to the Taliban. Bin Laden gets away. In February, General Tommy Franks tells a visiting senator Bush is moving equipment out of Afghanistan so he can invade Iraq. One of the men who prepped Rice for her testimony that Bush did not ignore pre-9/11 warnings later explains, quote, we cherry-picked things to make it look like the president had been actually concerned about al-Qaeda. They didn't give a bleep about al-Qaeda. July, and Britain's intel chief says Bush is fixing intelligence and facts around the policy to take out Saddam. January 03, Bush and Blair agreed to invade in March. Mr. Bush still telling us he has not decided, telling Blair they should paint an airplane in UN colors, fly it over Iraq, and provoke a response, a pretext for invasion. The man who said it would take several hundred thousand troops, fired. The man who said it would cost more than $100 billion, fired. The man who revealed Bush's yellow cake lie, smeared. His wife's covert status, exposed. The White House liars who did it and covered it up, not fired. One convicted. Bush commutes his sentence. Then in Iraq, stuff happens. Iraq's army disbanded. The government debathified. 200,000 weapons, billions of dollars just lost. Foreign mercenaries immunized from justice. Political hacks run the green zone. Religious cleansing forcing one out of six Iraqis from their homes. Abu Ghraib, the insurgency, al-Qaeda in Iraq. Other stuff does not happen. WMD, post-war planning, body armor, vehicular armor. The payoff? Oil and billions for Halliburton, Blackwater, and other companies. While Mr. Bush denies VA health care to 450,000 veterans, tries to raise their health care fees, blocks the new GI Bill, and increases his own power with the USA Patriot Act, with the Military Commissions Act. Public orders exempting himself from 1,000 laws and secretly from the Presidential Records Act, the Geneva Conventions, FISA, sparking a mass rebellion at the Justice Department. Secret star chambers for terrorism suspects, overturned by Hamdan v. Rumsfeld. Denying habeas corpus, overturned by Boumediene v. Bush. 200 renditionings, sleep deprivation, abuse. Rumsfeld warned in 2002 that he was tortured, that it would jeopardize convictions. Out of 550 at Gitmo, hundreds ultimately go free with no charges. Dozens are tortured, 8 fatally, 3 are convicted. On U.S. soil, 1,200 immigrants rounded up without due process, without bail, without court dates, without a single charge of terrorism. It wasn't just Mr. Bush no longer subject to the rule of law. He slashed regulations on everyone from banks to mining companies, appointed 98 lobbyists to oversee their own industries, weakening emission standards for mercury and 650 different toxic chemicals. Regulators shared drugs and their beds with industry reps. A Crandall Canyon mine owner told inspectors to back up because his buddy, Republican Mitch McConnell, was sleeping with their boss. McConnell's wife is Bush Labor Secretary Elaine Chao. Her agency overruled engineer concerns about Crandall Canyon and was found negligent after 9 miners died in the collapse there. Mr. Bush's hands-off is Enron blacks out California, doubling electric bills. After months of rejecting price caps, Mr. Bush bows to pressure. The blackouts end. Mr. Bush further deregulates commodity futures, midwifing the birth of unregulated oil markets, which, just like Enron, jack up prices to an all-time high until Congress and both presidential candidates call for regulations and the prices fall. Deregulating financial services and lax enforcement of remaining rules created a housing bubble, creating the mortgage crisis, creating then a credit crisis, devastating industries that rely on credit from student loans to car dealers. Those that had survived the Great Depression could not survive Bush. Those that did got $700 billion. No strings, no transparency, no idea whether it worked. Unlike the auto bailout, which cut workers' salaries, a GOP memo called it a chance to punish unions. But Bush failed even when his party and his patrons did not stand to profit. Investigators blame management cost-cutting communication for missed warnings about Columbia. Bush administration convicts include sex offenders at Homeland Security, convicted liars, every kind of thief in the calendar. And if you count things that were not prosecuted, the vice president of the United States actually shot a man in the face. The man apologized. Mr. Bush faked the truth with paid propaganda in Iraq on his education policy, tried to silence the truth about global warming, rocket fuel in our water, industry influence on energy policy, politicized the truth of science at NASA, the EPA, the National Cancer Institute, Fish and Wildlife, and the FDA. His lies exposed by whistleblowers from the cabinet down. Complete BS, the Treasury Secretary said, of Mr. Bush on his tax cuts. Rice's mushroom cloud, Powell's mobile labs, Iraq and 9/11, Jack Abramoff, Jessica Lynch, Pat Tillman again. The air at ground zero, most responders still suffering respiratory problems. Global warming, carbon emissions, a clear skies initiative lowering air quality standards, the healthy forest initiative increasing logging, faith-based initiatives, the cost of Medicare reform, fired U.S. attorneys, politically synchronized terror alerts, the surge causing insurgents to switch sides, that abortion causes breast cancer, that his first recession began under Clinton, that he did not wiretap without warrants, that we do not torture. That American citizen John Walker Lynn's rights were not violated, that he refused the right to counsel. Heck of a job, Brownie. Some survivors still in trailers, New Orleans still at just two-thirds its usual population. The lie that no one could have predicted the economic crisis except the economists who did. No one could have predicted 9/11 except one ass-covering CIA analyst or 30. No one could have predicted the levee breach except literally Mr. Bill, in a PSA that aired on TV a year before Katrina. Bush actually admitted that he lied about not firing Rumsfeld because he did not want to tell the truth. Look it up. All of it and more, leaving us with $10 trillion in debt to pay for 31% more in discretionary spending, the Iraq War, a $1.3 trillion tax cut, median income down $2,000, three-quarters of all income gains under Bush going to the richest 1%, unemployment up from 4.2 to 7.2%, the Dow down from 10,587 to 8,277, 6 million now more in poverty, 7 million more now without health care, buying toxic goods from China, deadly cribs, outsourcing security to Dubai, still unsecure at our ports and at our nuclear plants, more dependent on foreign oil, out of the International Criminal Court, off the anti-ballistic missile treaty, military readiness and standards down, with two unfinished wars, a nuclear North Korea, disengaged in the Palestinian problem, destabilizing Eastern European diplomacy with anti-missile plans, and unable to keep Russia out of Georgia. 2,000 miles of Appalachian streams destroyed by rubble from mountaintop mining. At his last G8 summit, he actually bid farewell to other world leaders, saying, quote, goodbye from the world's greatest polluter, consistently undermining historic American reverence for the institutions that empower us, education, now academic elites, and the law, activist judges capping jury awards. And bin Laden, living today unmolested in a Pakistani safe haven created by a truce, endorsed and defended by George W. Bush. And among all the gifts he gave to bin Laden, the most awful, the most damaging, not just to America, but to the American ideal, was to further bin Laden's goal by making us act out of fear rather than fortitude, leaving us with precious little to cling to tonight, save the one thing that might yet suffice. Hope.
It's going to take a lot of hope to undo that. Keith Olbermann, 8 years and 8 minutes, and that, of course, just scratches the surface. And there is much to debate and discuss within there, and whether or not the reality is that the new administration is going to change much, if any, of that. Now, as I was thinking about how long has this been going on, I hit the Obama label on MediaMonarchy.com. You know, the labels at the bottom of all the posts, that if you hit that, it'll show you all the posts that have that subject. So I hit Obama and went through page after page after page after page to get to the first mention that I found, at least initially, on MediaMonarchy.com of Barack Obama. Goes back 21 months ago. Back to April 25th, 2007, Giuliani warns of new 9/11 if Dems win. And I posted this up under the heading of "He Would Know." From Politico, again, April 25th, 2007, Giuliani said if a Democrat's elected president in 2008, America will be at risk for another terrorist attack on the scale of 9/11. But if a Republican is elected, he said, especially if it's him, terrorist attacks can be anticipated and stopped. If any Republican is elected president, I think obviously I'd be the best at this, we will remain on offense and will anticipate what the terrorists will do and try to stop them before they do it, Giuliani said. Now, the fireback from the Boston Globe. Democrats fire back at Giuliani on 9/11 warning. Democratic White House contenders Barack Obama and Hillary Rodham Clinton criticized Republican Rudolph Giuliani on Wednesday for suggesting a Democratic president would put the United States at risk of another September 11th-type terrorist attack. Rudy Giuliani has taken the politics of fear to a new low, and I believe Americans are ready to reject those kind of politics, Obama, an Illinois senator, said in a statement. The threat we face is real and deserves better than to be a punchline of another political attack, Obama said. First mention I could find of Barack Hussein Obama on MediaMonarchy.com, April 25th, 2007, Democrats fire back at Giuliani on 9/11 warning. So, flash forward 21 months through ridiculous bread and circus dog and pony show where any candidates who had anything real and progressive and substantive to talk about, like Nader or McKinney or Paul or Kucinich or Gravel, this is what we've got. This is what you want. This is what you get. Many postings, of course, that spanned the day before, day of, and day after the Obama-sia coronation. They're all massive postings, and they're all up for you on MediaMonarchy.com. All the links are there, all the videos, all the PDFs, all the photos, all the ridiculous things swirling around this coronation. First, from Monday, January 19th, Obama-sia coronation, the police state celebrates change. From the Washington Post, inauguration is climax to 2 years of increasing security around Obama as jubilant Democrats nominated Senator Barack Obama for president in a Denver convention hall in late August. The U.S. Secret Service in Washington placed its largest ever order for bulletproof glass. We covered that story extensively. The service requested about 5 tons of quote-unquote transparent armor, laminated with 4 layers of virtually unbreakable plastic to resist chemicals, flames, and multiple gunshots. When Obama is sworn in as the nation's 44th president, the ballistic shield will provide a final layer of safety in a massive exercise in presidential security, the culmination of 2 years of a steady ratcheting up of the protection around Obama to a level unseen for any of his predecessors. You can hit the link to police1.com and read more about ballistic shields and tactical police products. But this is the first of literally dozens of stories covering the amazing police state surrounding this coronation. Next, from the AFP, the French agency press, unprecedented security as Obama set for White House. Unprecedented security blanket. And what does a security blanket do? It makes you feel safe. It doesn't actually protect you, because that's impossible. An unprecedented security blanket has been draped over the U.S. Capitol for Obama's inauguration, and the threat level to the country's first black president is expected to remain high well beyond his swearing in. More than 12,500 active troops and military reservists, thousands of metropolitan police, as well as personnel from 57 departments around the nation, descended on Washington to protect against any potential terrorist attack during Tuesday's historic ceremony. More from Danger Room. Downtown D.C. becomes the Green Zone. In addition to a record number of house guests, with a link to the L.A. Times, and an explosion of kitsch, with a link to the UPI, Washington, D.C. is witnessing an unprecedented surge in security for the presidential inauguration. A force of 20,000 police officers, National Guard troops, and plainclothes agents, with a link to CBSNews.com, will be on the streets. And we're on the streets, and we're watching over you, and watching over the coronation festivities. F-16 fighters and Patriot missile batteries were on alert to defend the Capitol's airspace. Raw replay and NBC News cover Chertoff and the officials at the coronation searching for quote-unquote bigoted threats.
It is an extraordinary undertaking that starts with a lot of security, so let's start there. 58 law enforcement and other agencies, as well as 10,000 National Guard troops on hand to make sure that everything goes off without a hitch, and that's one of the reasons that this inaugural is expected to be the most expensive ever. The celebrations began on Saturday with a whistle-stop tour from Philadelphia to Washington. The Obamas following kind of an abridged version of Abraham Lincoln's journey by train to his own inauguration back in 1861. And then on Sunday, a sign of the kind of crowds that are being anticipated for the next couple of days. Several hundred thousand people turned out for a concert at the Lincoln Memorial. How about that for a setting? Featuring Bruce Springsteen, Garth Brooks, Beyonce, U2, and much more.
Pretty incredible. Of course, today is Martin Luther King Day, a day that's become a national day of service in honor of Dr. King's legacy. The Obamas are hoping to usher in a new era of service, and to do their part, they'll be joined by the Biden family today at a community renovation project here in Washington. This, as the rest of Washington prepares for tomorrow's official transfer of power, the inaugural ceremony, the parade down Pennsylvania Avenue. And we're going to preview it all for you today and put the moment in historic context as well.
But let's begin on this Monday morning with the security for the most carefully guarded inaugural ever. Thousands of police and National Guardsmen are already out in force. NBC Justice correspondent Pete Williams is at the National Mall with more on this. Hi, Pete. Good morning.
Matt, good morning to you. Those involved in the planning say there is no doubt about it. This will be the most heavily secured public event in U.S. history. It's partly the nature of the ceremony and partly the size of the expected crowd.
Federal agents say they know of no credible threat against tomorrow's inaugural.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear.
And even though every president brings unique security challenges,
so help me God,
those in charge of this inaugural say they're well aware of what's involved in protecting the first African American to take the oath.
That will excite bad acts on the part of a certain small percentage of the population who are bigoted. And so we want to be mindful that none of those people find their way into the area of proximity to the new incoming president.
That's why federal agents say they've combed through past threats against Obama and re-interviewed informants. In the subways and throughout the inaugural crowd, 155 intelligence teams will watch for signs of trouble.
All right, bring us in, Mark.
On the water, the U.S. Coast Guard is pushing its fast patrol boats even further out than it did for past inaugurals. It's partly a response to November's terror attack in Mumbai. The men responsible for it arrived by boat.
On Tuesday, those boats will shut down Washington's river traffic.
It'll be a very robust presence out here for the law enforcement assets that are out on the water.
Overhead, helicopters and military jets will enforce a strict no-fly zone. A force of 25,000 police, federal agents, and National Guardsmen, unprecedented in size, will provide protection and help control the crowds. This year will spread onto the long parkland of the National Mall. Security there got an early test at Sunday's concert at the Lincoln Memorial.
A dream of life comes to me.
With counter-snipers keeping a lookout. On Tuesday, 150 blocks of downtown Washington will be closed to traffic, and seven bridges from Northern Virginia will be open for the thousands of expected buses, but no private cars allowed. That has angered some.
I am, honored that we will have a new president, but I think that they're taking it a little bit too far.
But the director of the Secret Service says cars would jam the bridges, making them useless if needed for evacuation.
We want to make sure that if in the event there was any type of an incident, those who are here in town would be able to leave the district in an orderly fashion.
There's no dependable estimate yet of how many people are coming, but it's expected to easily break the record, 1.2 million people, for Lyndon Johnson's inaugural 44 years ago. Meredith?
Pete Williams, thank you.
Which makes me wonder, why did so many people show up for LBJ? Anyway, that's NBC talking to Chertoff, talking about bigoted threats, talking about the police state at the inauguration. More from Bloomberg, Washington mobilizes 42,500 strong security force for inaugural when senior FBI official Joseph Parrishini takes his 5 a.m. jog down Washington's National Mall. He imagines everything that could go wrong at Obama's inaugural. He said he thinks about the possibility of a sleet storm, bombing, chemical attack, or perhaps harnessed to guard against the lone gunman bent on turning a celebration into a national tragedy. But if we move to now another one from Raw Replay, this time from CNN. We heard them just mention the counter snipers, so let's learn more about those men in black.
Wow, they make it look so cool, don't they? But in real life, those men in black are in charge of protecting our next president. And they've got a far more nerve-wracking job because there is so much at stake. Our Gene Meserve is live at Freedom Plaza here in D.C. this morning to tell us what it's like to be a part of the Secret Service elite. Hey, Gene.
Hey, John, if you are here on the parade route tomorrow and you look up at the top of any of these buildings, you're likely to see them, men in black with rifles at the ready to protect the president.
First man, I got target one.
Target one.
Center.
Hit. They shoot with great accuracy at great distances.
Hit right eye.
And call it a blend of art and science. They are the counter-snipers of the U.S. Secret Service.
They're very good, and I would put them among the best in the world at what they do.
The counter-snipers consider themselves the most elite unit in the uniformed Secret Service. 9 weeks of intense training turned them into Olympic-quality shooters. They have to requalify monthly. Standards are so high, half of the agents accepted for training wash out.
Hit! Left long!
Each counter-sniper uses a rifle customized for his height and arm length. They work in two-man teams. Though both are expert marksmen, only one shoots at a time. The other gauges the wind, which can change a bullet's trajectory.
Hit! Hit! High in the forehead!
There are different methods. Smoke from chimneys, undulations, and the mirage from heat. Foliage on the trees, flagpoles.
When a president is going to move along a public route, the counter snipers scout it out to assess the threat and find good vantage points for themselves. On inauguration day, some will position themselves on rooftops with a view of the parade route, the crowd, and other buildings where snipers could be hiding. The cold will be biting, but the counter snipers can wear lightweight gloves, and they have tricks for keeping mental focus no matter what the weather.
When it's hot in the summer, we think about the cold days in January, and then in January we're thinking about what's happening in August.
And we can bet that tomorrow they're going to be thinking about August. And by the way, they make no effort to hide themselves. They want the bad guys to know they're there, ready to shoot. John?
You know, I've been trying to employ some of the psychological tricks this morning, pretending I'm actually on a beach in Florida this morning, Gene, but it's just not working. I don't know why. It's interesting, though, as you say, that they want... Yeah, it's interesting, though, as you say, that they want people to know that they're there. And we were at the Lincoln Memorial yesterday for the We Are One concert, and they were prominently displaying themselves on the top of the Lincoln Memorial. So they're really sending a message to people that we are here. If you've got any nefarious intent, you better think twice about it because we're watching you.
Exactly. The idea is deterrence. If people see them, they'll be less likely to do something they shouldn't do.
All right, Gene Meserve for us in Freedom Plaza this morning. Gene, thanks so much. It's great to see you.
That's a strange little clip from CNN. It could be an episode of Homeland Security USA, the new reality show. Fox News, Washington assembles largest inauguration security force ever. 2 million people, 4 million, bring them on. If, as expected, a record crowd turns out for Obama's inauguration, Washington will be ready with the largest number of security people ever assembled in the nation's capital. U.S. Secret Service overseeing a force, like we said, more than 40,000 people, 7,500 active duty soldiers, 10,000 National Guard, 25 law enforcement officers. But to put it into perspective, thanks Fox News, that surpasses the 31,000 troops serving in Afghanistan. Just think about that. and think about Obama and ending the war in Iraq so we can focus more on Afghanistan or Pakistan or Russia. Finally, from the Washington Times, as we go through this posting, Obamasiah coronation, the police state celebrates change, all the mainstream media accounts of the massive police state tactics. Hopefully I have linked in here somewhere, there's a Time magazine article that basically says, is a police state really necessary? But lastly, on this posting from the Washington Times, Capitol to be virtually locked down for inauguration. The estimated crowd of more than a million for the inauguration in the district also bring thousands of law enforcement and military from across the country in an unprecedented security effort. It's clear that this is a historic event, and we understand the kinds of crowds that have come out to see President-elect Obama on the campaign trail, said Agent Malcolm Wiley, a U.S. Secret Service spokesman, and we believe this crowd may be larger than we've seen during past inaugurations. And we move to the next post, which focuses on those crowds. And again, I've discussed, but I also say that it's hard to do all of this justice, and I don't do it justice, and I don't do as well as I want to try and get the ideas and points across. But we've talked about Obama and his mass movement, and folks like Webster Griffin Tarpley have written books and articles and lectures and more and more and more, talking about how this mirrors other fascist movements in countries throughout history. So let's see if we can explain it a little bit. A new article from Kurt Nimmo is the first I got posted up under this next one. This again from Monday, the day before the inauguration. Obamasiah coronation, the flock is led to the slaughter. Obama's mass movement gets a new mission. People don't remember what fascism was, I'm afraid. A lot of people think, especially here in the U.S. where people are ignorant, people believe that fascism is a purely top-down phenomenon. Author Webster Griffin Tarpley told the Dutch journalist Don De Witt during an interview on May 11, 2008. We played some of that for you. The link is to deepjournal.com for that full interview. Fascism is the march on Rome. Fascism is the stormtroopers fighting in the streets. It's a gutter and street level movement. It's a grassroots movement that has anti-authoritarian cover, anti-parliamentary, anti-Congress cover. It has left cover, left-wing cover. Mussolini, of course, was a revolutionary socialist, and a lot of people in his movement were left-wingers, extreme trade union activists, syndicalists, and stuff like this. In order for the banksters and the ruling elite behind Obama to realize their political agenda and wipe out all effective opposition in the process, the Obama mass movement, initially described as merely a grassroots political movement organized to get Obama elected, will now become Obama 2.0. or officially Organizing for America, a, quote, new group that aims to continue the grassroots advocacy that the former Illinois senator began in his presidential campaign.
When I'm sworn in as president of the United States, it will be because of you. You built the largest grassroots movement in history and shaped the future of this country. And the movement you built is too important to stop growing now. Today, I'm pleased to announce the creation of Organizing for America, the organization that will build on the movement you started during the campaign. As president, I will need the help of all Americans to meet the challenges that lie ahead. That's why I'm asking people like you, who fought for change during the campaign, to continue fighting for change in your communities. Since the election, hundreds of thousands of you shared your ideas about how this movement should move forward, and we've listened carefully. Volunteers, grassroots leaders, and ordinary citizens will continue to drive our organization, helping us bring about the changes we proposed during the campaign. A solution to our economic crisis, an end to the war in Iraq, affordable health care for all, and new sources of energy to power our economy and protect our environment. Joe Biden and I will be working with Congress to bring about change in Washington. But we cannot do this without you. The change we've worked so hard for will not happen unless ordinary Americans get involved. And supporters like you must lead the way. You'll be receiving more information in the next few days about this organization and how you can continue to play a crucial role in our journey to change America. I look forward to continuing that journey with you, and I thank you for everything you've done for this movement and for our country.
Obama 2.0, Organizing for America, the Obama Mass Movement. There are links in there to the Washington Post and Reuters and even LaRouchePack.com. But the aforementioned DeepJournal.com, again, they have it posted up, an interview and the transcript with Webster Tarpley going back to May 16th, 2008. The men behind Obama, especially in politics, it is of the utmost importance to try to look behind the facade. Who makes up the team of the presidential candidate? The future president of the United States of America is for a large part dependent on and being fed by his team of advisors and future cabinet members. Webster Tarpley wrote a book on the men and women behind Obama. He argues that there's more to Obama than his charismatic appearance, and that some of his advisors pose a danger to the U.S. and the world in case, and now, Obama has become the president. Whether Tarpley's view is correct is a matter of opinion and remains to be seen, but for the public debate, it is relevant to take note of his facts and arguments. So, there's an interview. It's about a half hour with Webster Tarpley. And that's what it's been all about as we look at all the ins and outs and the questions. I think I went over last week that the Obama citizenship question is the sort of controlled demolition of Obama truth. It gets all the attention, but it doesn't really get us anywhere, it seems, when all the eggs are put in that basket. When I think what I've tried to do on the show is just look at the advisors. Look at who he's with. Look at where they all come from. They come from a relatively small field. As we've covered many times before, we'll hit it again. Many, many, many of them all come from either the corrupt Chicago cesspool. You know, they're bringing those guys up. But it's the CFR Bilderberg guys. It's the same. The Trilaterals, the Brzezinskis, the Volkers. The same folks who brought us the chaos of the late 70s and the black ops and the overthrows, and the training, and the funding. All those folks are back, if they ever really went away. So I think that's why I like always trying to follow Tarpley's work as he looks at their connections. So I think that's where it's at. Moving on through the flock has led to the slaughter. Again, these are all coming from the day before as we set the stage. High in anticipation, celebrations begin as Obama's inauguration nears. This from McClatchy. Of course, Obama and his four-stop train tour that drew thousands along the way and paid homage to the arduous inaugural journey made by his political hero, Abraham Lincoln, 148 years ago. There's another one, in Obama's inaugural train ride from Swampland blog over on Time, another from McClatchy. Americans flock to D.C. to be part of Obama's inauguration. A very fitting title. Judy Wortham of Nashville, Tennessee, saw the fleece hat and had to have it. Shiny and bedazzled as it was, decorated in a sparkly copy of Shepard Fairey's iconic painting of President-elect Obama. Anything that goes like this, bling bling, she said, making blinking motions with her hands before she sat down to lunch at Old Ebbett Grill near the White House. Anything that's shiny. So, of course, I love the new president. Going overboard with Obama souvenirs. Another one from Time magazine, of course, Danger Room referenced all the kitschy items and souvenirs and garbage. Cashing in. Cash in now, honey. From the Washington Post, nation's hopes high for Obama. Poll shows even as they express deep concern about the current direction of the country, Americans are overwhelmingly optimistic about Obama and are pinning their hopes for recovery from a massive economic collapse on the president-elect, according to a new Washington Post ABC News poll with a link for you to the full poll and all the questions and all the percentiles and all that. Nearly 8 in 10 of those surveyed say the country's headed seriously off course. 7 in 10 worry about their family's finances, and 94% say the country's economy is not so good or poor. The most negative assessment in more than 23 years of Washington Post ABC polling. Obama will take office as the most popular incoming president in a generation. He will also enter the White House with a broad mandate to act that was missing when George W. Bush was elected by the narrowest of margins in 2000. So at least fortunately the poll shows that people know that shit's not right. We'll always, of course, blame it on the last guy going out, as we get double teamed by the false left-right one-party bullshit. So on the one hand, the people are in this poll, at least, are awake to we're on the wrong track. But they're pinning, let's go back, quote, pinning their hopes for recovery from a massive economic collapse on the president. Obama's train journey describes arc of U.S. history. That's from Deutsche Press. And lastly, on this flock being led to the slaughter, posting Obama's inauguration to generate over a half billion pounds of CO2. This from businessandmedia.org. Here's an environmental impact story you're not likely to see in the mainstream media. Neither NBC's chief environmental affairs correspondent Ann Thompson, nor ABC correspondent Bill Blakemore, nor CBS 60 Minutes correspondent Scott Pelley, all of whom who have been eager over the years to expose so-called crimes against the environment, have rushed to report on the massive carbon footprint of the Obama inauguration. None of them rushed to mention it. But a comprehensive new study by the Institute for Liberty, and you can download that. It's a small little half-meg PDF. The Institute for Liberty took an in-depth look at each component of the January 20th inauguration in D.C. and estimated that 575 million pounds of carbon dioxide will be emitted into the atmosphere for the inauguration, which is roughly equal to what the average American household would produce in, about 58,000 years. Take that for what it's worth. I do not know who the Institute for Liberty is, but it's base irony. It's a hoot, as Bill Hicks would say. It's real simple, but it's a hoot. We're going to move now to the next one. One more day before posting on the Obama-Saya coronation. Such a big party for so little change. First from ABC, Obama's inauguration financed partially by bailed out Wall Street executives. The country's in the middle of the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, which isn't stopping rich donors and the government from spending $170 million or more on the inauguration. The actual swearing-in ceremony will cost $1.24 million, according to Carol Floorman, spokeswoman for the Joint Congressional Committee on Inaugural Ceremonies. It's the security parties and countless porty potty rentals that really run up the bills. Links in there and more to ABC News. And another Wall Street becomes top Obama donor. That's from PressTV.ir out of Iran. Wall Street becomes top Obama donor. According to a study conducted by the Center for Responsive Politics, executives of finance, insurance, and real estate companies and their family members have donated $7.1 million to the inaugural committee. The center said the wealthiest Americans, from finance moguls to Hollywood stars, have given huge sums to the committee, hoping to gain more influence in the Obama administration. But from the New York Times, another one that shines a light on the false left-right game. Obama reaches out for McCain's counsel. Not long after Senator John McCain returned last month from an official trip to Iraq and Pakistan, he received a phone call from Obama. As contenders for the presidency, the two had hammered each other for much of 2008 over their conflicting approaches to foreign policy, especially in Iraq. He'd lose a war. He'd stay 100 years. Now, however, Mr. Obama said he wanted Mr. McCain's advice. People in each camp briefed on the conversation said, what did he see on the trip? What did he learn? It was just one step in a post-election courtship that historians say has few modern parallels. Beginning with a private meeting in Obama's transition office in Chicago just 2 weeks after the vote. Monday night, January 19th, the night before, McCain was the guest of honor at a black tie dinner celebrating Obama's inauguration. There's a link in there to Yahoo, and if you dig somewhere through MediaMonarchy.com, you'll find all the other stories about how they were sharing some notes about what their cabinets were going to look like. Obama has 4 years to save the Earth. That's from The Guardian. That's from an interview with Jim Hansen. Barack Obama has only 4 years to save the world. That's the stark assessment of NASA. There's NASA again. NASA and Obama. A connection we've been tracking now for seemingly 3 or 4 weeks. That's the stark assessment of NASA scientist and leading climate expert Jim Hansen, who last week warned only urgent action by the new president could halt the devastating climate change that now threatens the Earth. Crucially, the action will have to be taken within Obama's first administration. We must have a worldwide carbon tax. Paid to private banks. You could do all those things. Play, pray, and pay. But where I stole the title of this posting, Such a Big Party for So Little Change, was from Chris Floyd of Empire Burlesque. Of course, one of the better writers and minds in this new 21st century online journalism world. Big party, small change. Baby, we were born to run the empire. Chris Floyd writes, I understand there's a big party going on in Washington this week where hundreds of thousands of people are gathering to celebrate Bob Gates' retention as Pentagon chief. I mean, that is what this shindig's all about, isn't it? Hope and continuity. We've got Bush's man still driving the war machine. We've got Bush's general still waging the war on terror all over the world. We got a president who's eager to spend his political capital on slashing entitlements because everyone must sacrifice. Everybody's going to have some skin in this game. Everyone, that is, except for the president's Wall Street backers, who are about to receive yet another tranche of billions of taxpayer dollars in what they're now calling openly and rightly opportunity funding. We got a president honoring homophobic right-wing preachers who urge their followers to imitate the mindless zeal of Nazis and Bolsheviks and doing, quote, whatever it takes to establish Christianist dominion. We got a president whose education chief believes in turning over the teaching of Americans' children to corporations and the military. We've even got a president who follows Cheney's good advice on interrogating terror war captives. It seems like the only place you can find change in Washington these days is in the cup of a street beggar left homeless and jobless in the great bankrupting of the nation by Wall Street and the war machine. Chris Floyd. Links in there to ABC News, Tom Dispatch, godlessliberalhomo.blogspot.com, TruthDig, Washington Post, on and on, celebrating the retention of Bob Gates, of course, involved with Brzezinski and Operation Cyclone and Iran-Contra and all of it. But you can always count on Hugo Chavez to stir shit up and say something outrageous and generally totally necessary and right on and needed. Chavez says Obama has stench of Bush. This is from Reuters. And you'll also recall, of course, that when Chavez and Bush were at the UN at around the same time. Of course, Chavez said, "I can still smell the sulfur from the devil being here." Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said last Saturday Obama had the stench of his predecessor as U.S. president and was at risk of being killed if he tries to change the American empire. Most world leaders expect a new era of U.S. foreign relations when Obama was sworn in. But Chavez said frayed ties with Washington were unlikely to improve despite the departure of Bush, who the Venezuelan leader has often called the devil. I hope I'm wrong, but I believe Obama brings the same stench. Sitepoint.com, Obama's web wasteland. This is kind of an interesting sidebar. So, I keep getting tripped up on the tenses. So, as Obama was sworn in, of course, historic moment, blah-de-dee-blah. His campaign had a good deal of significance in the terms of how it utilized the internet. The internet will play a huge part in, of course, the inaugural festivities and then after that. But what has happened to the vast social networks that Obama built during the campaign? What will happen to them? The interesting thing, if you go to sitepoint.com and follow Obama's web wasteland as they track how all the Twitter and Facebook and MySpace and all the social networking things died. But as we just went over on the last posting, talking to Tarpley, Kurt Nimmo, and the Reuters report, Organizing for America, Obama's mass movement gets a new mission. They'll all be Twittered into some sort of activity. High school censors inappropriate comments about the Obama Messiah. DaytonDailyNews.com. Superintendent warns against inappropriate comments. As we see the crackdown. New York City councilman proposes mandatory public service for students. This from the Epoch Times. Councilman Eric Goya, G-I-O-I-A, with a link to ericgoya.com. Democrat from Queens, and representatives from City Year, New York Cares, Common Cause New York, and Big Brothers Big Sisters gathered at the Church of St. Francis Xavier on Sunday, January 18th. Eric Goya proposed that New York City create a requirement of 20 hours of community service for high school graduation, inspired by President-elect Barack Obama's calling the nation to service in his inauguration and Mayor Michael Bloomberg's pledging to encourage public service at the State of the City address delivered last week. More talk. Now, of course, as all these things go, it always starts out good. It starts out for a good reason. And I'm not saying helping your community and service is a bad thing. Far from it. It starts with reasonable things, and it moves on to the snitch state, to the nanny state, to ratting on your neighbors, to the green brigades digging through your garbage. There's more, of course. There's so many links in these stories. It's all over the place. Washington goes into security clampdown for inauguration. That's from Raw Story and the AFP. But let's move to a few other disturbing things. So in the supposed mass movement, in the supposed grassroots uprising, grassroots uprisings don't generally, to my knowledge, have anything to do with Starbucks and Ashton Kutcher and Demi Moore and pledges of service. Starbucks asks the fascistic musical question, "Are you in?"
Come on, everybody. We can do it. Join the grassroots movement.
Right away, together moving forward toward a bright day.
We have the tools.
tools and the skills, and we're capable to change the world and make it more sustainable. Together we are strong and our bonds are unbreakable. If we act bold, we can attain the goal. Let's have the courage, or we could be a service. Planting seeds when they flourish, everybody will be nourished. Together we are better, nothing to it but to do it. It's a grassroots movement.
Let's all do together, every woman and man.
I pledge to bring awareness to mental disease,
to advance stem cell research,
to spread the awareness of autism.
I pledge
to show more love to strangers,
to meet my neighbors,
find out their names.
I'm gonna give them a smile
and ask them how I can be of service to them.
I pledge to be a better mentor to my younger sisters,
to continue to be a mentor for big brothers, big sisters.
I pledge
to reduce my use of plastic
by starting with using less bottled water,
to plant 500 trees this year to help our planet,
to be more green,
to no longer use plastic bags at the grocery store,
to consume less and cultivate more,
so that we are on this planet forever.
For the environment, I pledge to flush only after a deuce, never a single.
I pledge.
I pledge to turn the lights off, because I used to leave the lights on, but we want to conserve energy, so I'm turning the lights off, you turn the lights off.
I pledge
to sell my obnoxious car and buy a hybrid,
to drive slower and not use as much gas.
I pledge to volunteer my time
to express the importance of arts education in our schools,
to sell a culture of intelligence instead of ignorance.
I pledge to help children understand just because they come from a small place doesn't mean they can't dream big.
Am I such a cynical bastard that I find those things to be disgusting propaganda? So, celebrities on MySpace, myspace.com/presidential pledge. And before that, we heard the Starbucks ad, RUN. It's a grassroots movement funded by multinational corporations, fool. Yeah, change. Paid for by Goldman Sachs. So, Raw Story has this posted up under the headline. I had to double check this. Celebrities make service pledge videos to Obama on MySpace. On the eve of Barack Obama's inauguration, more than 50 celebrities have teamed up on MySpace to record videos making a pledge of service to the next president of the United States. I don't pledge to a dude, to some person. The disturbing cult of personality rears its ugly head. So on the flip side, however, again from Raw Story, 350,000 conservatives pledge to block Obama's socialistic agenda. A conservative group, grassfire.org, announced on Monday that its online petition pledging patriotic opposition to Obama has gathered 350,000 signatures. Grassfire's founder Steve Elliott stated, quote, "This is not a personal attack on Obama. On the contrary, this is a call to action for conservatives who profess love for our country and respect for our institutions. Our disagreements with the president are based in ideology and public policy only. From this firm foundation, we are mounting a patriotic, resilient, conservative resistance to Obama's agenda." More links in there to Yahoo as well as grassfire.org. Excuse me. From Reuters, man charged with threatening Obama on his website. And to the Washington Times, we covered it last week, of course, the first ever Masonic inaugural ball. Masonic rituals live on in inauguration. President-elect Barack Obama's swearing-in Tuesday incorporated several elements out of America's Masonic past. One-third of the signers of the Constitution, many of the Bill of Rights signers in America's first few presidents, except, of course, for Thomas Jefferson, were Freemasons, a fraternal organization that became public in early 18th century England. Although it became fabulously popular in America, at one time encompassing 10% of the population, Pope Clement XII condemned Freemasonry in 1738 as heretical. The latest pronouncement was issued in 1983 by then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict XVI, who called Masonic practices irreconcilable with Catholic doctrine. Still, As the first president, George Washington had to come up with appropriate rituals for the new country. He borrowed many of them from Masonic rites he knew as a quote-unquote worshipful leader of a lodge in Alexandria. His Masonic gavel is on display at the Capitol Visitor Center. Until this inauguration, Washington's Masonic Bible, on which he swore his obligations as a Freemason, was used for the presidential oath of office. President-elect Barack Obama will use Abraham Lincoln's Bible. Masonic rituals live on in the inauguration. Links in there for things about Abraham Lincoln's Bible and more about worshipful leaders, and more from FreemasonryWatch.org, the Catholics versus the Freemasons. Interestingly enough, fortunately, from 911blogger.com, new 9/11 brochure was made available at the inauguration, DC911Truth.org. DC911Truth produced an attractive new brochure to be distributed at the inauguration and surrounding events. On the cover, Obama's asked to, quote, help America learn the truth about 9/11. You can download the pamphlet. It's a little PDF. And the interior aimed at general audiences who may not be aware of problems with the official account or who may be quick to dismiss any questions as conspiracy theories. I have a JPEG photo of it posted up. The brochure looks good. That's, of course, sometimes the problem with any kind of controversial literature, whether it's on a website or on a flyer, that sometimes they can look like the ravings of someone who's raving. You know what I mean. Last few headlines, last few links on this Such a Big Party for So Little Change. Alex Jones has been doing new audio blogs that he just kind of records on a little digital recorder and posts up. So some of those links are there as the 19th and the 20th, the day before in the inauguration. But we'll get to more in just a second from him. But that link is there, audio link for you. However, there's a video that is more bizarre propaganda from Air Force One, Obama's first official USAF flight.
In what has become a tradition, the new pilot takes command of America's flagship as the new president takes command of the United States. Colonel Turner's first official flight as the new pilot. Pick up President-elect Obama in Chicago and fly him to Washington, D.C.
Hey, sir. Good afternoon.
My name is Scott
Turner. Nice to meet you.
Good to see you. You're the pilot of Air Force One?
Yes, sir. It'll be my pleasure to serve you as a pilot.
You know, I got to say, you're out of Central Cast. You're exactly what I want the pilot of Air Force One to look like.
Thank you,
look
sir.
Like you know how to fly. You look like Sam Shepard in the right side.
Thank you very much, sir. On behalf of everyone in Air Force One, I'd like to invite you, sir. Welcome you aboard.
Thank you.
And introduce you to Reggie Dixon.
Welcome, sir. So nice to see you, sir.
My pleasure to meet you, sir.
Thank you.
Welcome aboard.
How long?
There is one thing he can be guaranteed. It's the fact that the presidential other group will be prepared and ready at all times. No question.
We're going to serve a dinner tonight. I'm not sure if you had dinner already. This is a menu we have available for you.
I'll see how you guys do a burger. Make it medium well.
Okay. By all means.
And cheddar cheese if you got the cheddar cheese.
Sir, you know I got it.
All right.
Cheddar cheese?
Cheddar cheese.
We have it.
And I take Dijon Musselburger. That's what I'm going to take.
Okay. Dijon or the Great Poupon?
That's fine. And
okay.
Tomato.
Yes, sir.
All right. And if you have like some salad or some vegetables or something.
Yes, sir. No fries or anything like that?
Well, I'll still take a fry.
Yes, sir. Well, I can show you. I don't know if you want to see the rest of the airplane at this point in time.
Let's go. Run the
Air Force One is Air Force One. It's not dependent on who's sitting in the chair. It is our responsibility to the office. And absolutely, of course, we will carry that forward with the same expertise and perfection we do today.
Like I said, strange propaganda. I believe that's produced by National Geographic. Nice little PR for the military and Air Force One. At least Obama does mention Sam Shepard and the right stuff in there. Of course, Sam Shepard playing West Virginian Chuck Yeager, first man to break the sound barrier. But I digress. Obama considering government-run bad bank for decaying assets. That's from Raw Story as well. Black History illuminates inauguration. That's from the Washington Times. Obama commemorates MLK Day with service. That's from the Washington Post. What was Barack Obama like in 1990? This is a strange and eerily prophetic article that's posted up on thestar.com. Hard to believe it was almost 19 years ago that the Star first ran this photo and feature on Barack Obama. Today, his ambitious goals and youthful views, not to mention the reactions to them, seem eerily prophetic. So, a 19-year-old article posted up for you. I'll just read just a bit from it. Barack Obama stares silently at a wall of fading black and white photographs in the muggy second floor offices of the Harvard Law Review. He lingers over one row of solemn faces, his predecessors of 40 years ago. All are men. All are dressed in dark colored suits and ties. All are white. It's a sobering moment for Obama, 28, who in February became the first black to be elected president in the 102-year history of the prestigious student-run law journal. And it goes on to paint the bizarre parallels. And I believe we'll ask the question in a little bit, is this, of course, the classic American tale of rising up, pulling yourself up, making it, or are there more things at play? Lastly, on this Such a Big Party for So Little Change, a video, Obama comments, this was while it was another PR stunt on the National Service Day painting, and that's a good thing. Again, I don't want to be such a dick and say that doing good things for old people and painting schools is a bad thing. But at this photo op, Obama mentioned something that I haven't posted anything up on the site about, and I haven't made any mention of, but we should, and that's, of course, the plane that crashed in New York.
You sweep floors for a living, and make sure you're the best floor sweeper there has ever been. All right? And, you know, I spoke to Sully, the pilot who landed at USA Air flight in the Hudson, and he said, me and my crew, we were just doing our job, and it made you think, if everybody did their job, whatever that job was, as well as that pilot did his job, it'd be a pretty good thing. So, you know, doing your job well, finishing your job, you know, cooperating as a team, all that stuff's important. I think I got this wall covered. Anybody, I think it's pretty. Yeah, I mean, maybe this is a little dark because it's dry. All right, what else we got for them?
We got some stuff downstairs. Yeah, we're going to craft school. We're going to pull a bit without us.
Okay, go. All right, see you guys. You got enough.
Another strange bit of propaganda. That's Obama talking about the pilot who crashed. And if you caught it at the beginning of the clip, which of course it's edited and there's too much going on, he says even if you're a floor sweeper, be the best floor sweeper in the world. But he mentions the plane that crashed in the Hudson, which I haven't mentioned at all. It seemed to swirl around the exact time that Bush was giving his last speeches and his last press conferences, that the idea that a plane crashing in New York was keeping 9/11 and Bush ingrained in your head. But now we've made it to January 20th, the day of. So the first thing I posted up on that day, media execs prep for news emergency. This from Politico.com. Media executives must have been paying attention last week when President Bush declared a state of emergency for the inauguration. CNN's Washington Bureau Chief David Borman, for one, issued a news emergency of his own. It's the biggest event any of us have ever had to cover. It goes through all the points on how they basically operate in what is an occupied city, and how it's a huge circus, and how the media was going to be ready for anything to happen. And it has little funny things about slumber parties and sleeping in your office so you're already downtown for the thing. And I just thought the headline of Media Execs Prep for News Emergency was rather ominous. And I, of course, through all of this, have had sort of knot in my stomach about everything. Either real or imagined. I suppose I should tell you right now, we're well into hour number two of this 108th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 23rd, 2009. Coming to you, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network, live every Friday morning, praradio.org, revereradio.net. And we're going over the coronation. Obama-Sai coronation. Yay! We're out of the frying pan! We've made it, finally, to the new commander-in-chief being sworn in.
Are you prepared to take the oath, Senator?
I am.
I, Barack Hussein Obama,
I Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the office of President of the United States faithfully. And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President. All the best.
Whoops. Stepping into history, Barack Hussein Obama grasped the reins of power as America's first black president on Tuesday, saying the nation must choose hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord to overcome the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. In frigid temperatures, an exuberant crowd of more than a million packed the National Mall and parade route to celebrate Obama's inauguration in a high noon ceremony. They filled the National Mall, stretching from the inaugural platform at the U.S. Capitol to the Lincoln Memorial in the distance. With 11 million Americans out of work and trillions of dollars lost in the stock market's tumble, Obama emphasized that his biggest challenge is to repair the tattered economy left behind by outgoing President George W. Bush. It's all Bush's fault. More from Yahoo, more from the AP. Inauguration security tight after threats received. There were supposed threats, and then supposedly there weren't. And of course, it's never anything specific. One of the more interesting nuggets in all this, of course, it comes from Danger Room. As security enveloped the Capitol, Defense Secretary Robert Gates hides out in a continuity of government scheme as the designated successor. As the crowds descended on the National Mall to hear Obama take the oath, security in Washington was tighter than ever. 10,000 National Guard troops on duty, task force orchestrated by the Secret Service, uniformed police, plainclothes officers, representatives, dozens of government agencies. Perhaps the most important security precaution, however, is being taken by the Pentagon. As part of a continuity of government scheme, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates will go to an undisclosed location where he will ride out the inaugural festivities as Obama's designated successor in the event of some catastrophe. The White House announced the plan on Monday, the 19th, the day before the inauguration. Pentagon spokesman told the AFP that Gates, quote, will be spending the day at a military installation outside the National Capital Region. More from the LA Times on that, as well as defenselink.mil. But yes, the unelected head of the United States war machine was hiding out in a government bunker. Maybe it was in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. It was under the Clarion, or the Fish and Wildlife place there. But that wouldn't be outside the Washington zone, National Capital Region. Unelected head of the military is the designated successor. So if something happened and blew up D.C., Robert Gates was the designated successor. Think about that. Of course, linked up transcripts of the inaugural address, which I have to say, we have a, God forbid, television set that I can get a fuzzy ABC. So, of course, on the morning of the inauguration, I had it on. I also had streams going of other radios and all kinds of things. news overload, like I do. It was a pretty dark speech, and short, and not very, woohoo, it was, oh, fuck. From LouRockwell.com, inaugural inanity. 10,000 National Guardsmen, 7,500 active duty soldiers, 25,000 cops from 99 federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies, a city honeycombed with communication command centers spying on supposedly free Americans with 5,265 surveillance cameras, and as if we aren't already up to our eyes in goons, an entire brigade of the U.S. Army on call. The cost for this hyperbolic hysteria? Hundreds of millions at a time when taxpayers can't scrape together next month's mortgage, all for an inauguration that has attracted no specific threats. Critics contend that this is overkill. Go figure. You can say this for the TSA and the millions of Americans cheering an emperor who has no clothes. They deserve one another. Shoe bombers strike Washington. Great photos, great videos. Goodbye, Bush. Chant in crowded Washington metro area. This from the Deutsche Press Agency. Washington thrummed with excitement Tuesday as tens of thousands in crowded subway cars poured through the streets, celebrate the end of one era and the beginning of another. The end of the beginning. In just the few hours as Obama took over from Bush, metro riders L'Enfant Plaza, stalled by train problems, began to sing goodbye, Bush, over and over and over, they chanted. The mood was as much an outpouring of support for the country's first African-American president as it was a celebration of the Republican president's departure after 8 increasingly unpopular years in the White House. One bright note, I would say, Bush did actually commute the sentences of Ramos and Compeon, the border guys, who shot an illegal drug smuggler who had a gun, I believe, pointed at them. One of the other good bits, and found this out the night before the inauguration, but let's return again. One more note from Keith Olbermann and Darth Cheney.
Good evening from Washington. This is Monday, January 19th, hours until the inauguration of President-elect Barack Obama and the end of an error. And there is breaking news at this hour that seems like a metaphor for that error. Vice President Cheney has today hurt his back while moving boxes into his new home in McLean, Virginia. He will attend tomorrow's inauguration here in a wheelchair.
Cheney finally wheeled away. It was quite the joy to be able to see Darth Cheney get wheeled off in a wheelchair. However, I would rather him see him in The Hague. And it was, of course, a joy to see Bush get in the helicopter and fly away like some disgraced, disgusting Nixon. And I saluted him with the middle finger. And then, of course, found out later that, of course, millions of other people were doing the same thing. Moving quickly, if I'm ever going to get through all this ridiculous things, even from the first day, Limbaugh, of course, says, I hope Obama fails. That's from thinkprogress.org. How Obama is wooing the military from Time Magazine. It goes through basically a nice little photo op appearance and how the military really likes Obama, and they'll really be down to do whatever he says. There's a video from, again, Swampland on Time, Obama's National Day of Service, or Obama's Day of National Service. But 19th was MLK Day. So, on the 19th, it was MLK Day. On the 20th, they inaugurated a new president who also is black. Some people connect the two events. They can't be serious. Even after the ceasefire, civilians in Gaza are still being slaughtered, and Obama's silence is deafening. Like McCain, Obama went to AIPAC on bended knee to get their blessing. Link for you to that whole video. We covered it in The Thrall of AIPAC, Why Obama Can't Save Us, going back to January of 2008 on MediaMonarchy.com. It's an insult to King and his memory to compare the two. Obama needs to earn the comparison, and right now, he is far from it.
Time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. What do they think as we test out our latest weapons on them, just as the Germans tested out new medicine and new tortures in the concentration camps of Europe. Now that is little left to build on save bitterness. We are met by a deep but understandable mistrust. To speak for them is to explain this lack of confidence in Western words, and especially their distrust of American intentions now. The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. This way of settling differences is not just. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours.
The differences are amazingly apparent. That is a real anti-war leader. Pro-peace leader. That's Martin Luther King. Silence is betrayal. Moving quickly, or at least trying to, and do it justice. From Wikinews, Obama's We Are One concert for Lemmings, brought to you by HBO, Disney, and Verizon. That attracted 400,000. From Threat Level, however, Obama to defend telecom spy immunity. The incoming Obama administration will vigorously defend congressional legislation immunizing U.S. telecom companies from lawsuits about their participation in the domestic spy program. That was the assessment by Eric Holder, new attorney general, who made the statement during his confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Change. Change you can spy on. Overflow of updates. Run down the list. From everywhere, from Press TV to McClatchy. It's the addresses, the bids goodbye, the fact checks. Of course, Obama goofs right off the bat on the amount of presidents that have been sworn in. Obama's speech censored in China. Chris Matthews, exuberant at the inauguration, gushes about how great the new MSNBC is.
Well, there's one thing you can't see at home. I have never seen so many teeth in my life. Everybody is smiling. I mean, it's all teeth out there when you get close.
Well,
every time I look out at the crowd, the people have got big smiles.
Combination of a smiling and the weather.
Yeah, well, that's
because
too.
There's some chattering going
like
on.
The teeth
right.
Start to get, your lip starts to stick. But I'll tell you, it is radiant happiness. In fact, just us lucky enough to be in this business today, looking out the window here and getting the reaction when the crowd catches your eye. It is such a deal.
Well, as we noticed, again, we all walked through this crowd to some degree. I don't know how many good mornings were said today.
Well, it sure as hell helps to be on MSNBC today.
Right.
Let's talk straight here.
All right.
This is the network that has opened its heart to change and its possibilities. Let's be honest about it. These people watch this network out here.
Oh, being so modest, and of course, there's Olbermann sneaking in again on the Microsoft General Electric network. Record masses of 2 million meet Obama-sai on the mall. That's from the Washington Times. Media unleash round-the-clock Obama mania. Hardly in office, and already Obama makes a mistake. Again, from McClatchy, again, the amount of presidents that have been inaugurated. Few protesters at inauguration. That's from the New York Times. A slideshow from Time magazine. Oprah and Obama shared a top-secret dinner just a short distance away from the White House, Oprah and Obama joining forces for the new age. However, on the morning of the inauguration, Alex Jones was on Russia Today, of course, putting it out that, of course, everyone's going to be immensely disappointed in the Obama-siah.
Well, to comment on this historic moment in American history, we're now joined live on the phone by radio host Alex Jones. Hello to you, Alex Jones. Obama's pre-election campaign was focused on getting the U.S. out of the crisis, but this inauguration is the most expensive in the country's history. In a time of financial crisis, is spending so much money on an inauguration appropriate?
Well, look, the Anglo-American establishment is bragging in Newsweek magazine, the Financial Times of London, London, Henry Kissinger, has said on CNBC television that they have orchestrated the financial crisis. The oligarchs of England and the United States are engineering this entire thing, so they could care less about $150 million for inauguration and a few hundred million more for 47,000 armed regular army troops and police on the streets turning America into another police state. So, $150 million for parties at his inauguration is nothing compared to the overall program that they're carrying out. Obama is betraying everyone. In U.S. history, we have never worshipped a leader as God. But our corporate media is saying this guy is basically God. They are trying to get the public behind all these unpopular things, like $8.5 trillion stolen by the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve out of the U.S. Treasury in the last 3 months, along with banker takeover bills. Even Bloomberg News admits War Powers Act has been declared. Congress has been threatened with physical martial law if they don't go along with this. Bush has passed the baton to Barack Obama. He's going to try to get international support to circle Russia further, to move weapon systems into Russia, to escalate tensions with Iran. Barack Obama, if people didn't like George Bush, they're going to hate Barack Obama. This guy is a corporate creation of the banking elite in this country. And so, of course, while people are losing their jobs, and many economists, including Economist Magazine, are saying we're going into a depression, of course he's partying like it's 1999. Of course he's having a great time. Of course he's arrogantly up there making Mona Lisa, Benito Mussolini faces, and, you know, holding his head high with the chin up in the air. They want this guy to act like a messianic savior, and it's not going to work. They're setting up youth brigades, the compulsory national service in the United States. They're organizing what Mao Zedong did, a separate group outside government at usaservice.org, where people will openly serve him, just like Mao's youth corps. You cannot make this type of stuff up. The world needs to dread Barack Hussein Obama.
Putting it down, Alex Jones on Russia Today. Youth brigades, green brigades, pledges, corporate creations. So the question that we mentioned earlier, Obama's rise due to blue blood ancestry or the power of the American dream? You can, of course, follow the connections to being cousins with Bush and Cheney and all their connections to Vlad the Impaler and Brad Pitt. Ted Kennedy was taken out on a stretcher from the luncheon at the inauguration after experiencing convulsions. We'll, of course, get to Caroline Kennedy pulling out from the Senate and the new updates on that. However, the first note of this, and as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh, I swim in these waters. I can tell you, the inaugural oath thing is going to become a conspiracy. So first, on CNN, they said it. Robert screwed up the oath.
The president of the United States, Barack Obama, we no longer call him the president-elect. He is the president of the United States. He's been president now for almost 50 minutes. He became president even before he was officially administered the oath of office by the Chief Justice John Roberts, because exactly at noon Eastern, according to the United States Constitution, he becomes president of the United States, oath or not. And they were running a little bit behind schedule. That's why he became president even before he was formally sworn in.
An interesting, we're about to see them coming down the steps, heading toward the helicopter. David Gergen, an interesting moment, though, which we have not yet talked about, though, which will be much talked about in the hours ahead. The actual oath of office by John Roberts, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, he messed up.
He seemed to scramble the words there on about this. The second, but first, I wasn't sure. Did Barack Obama scramble that?
If Jeff Toobin is around, he's the authority on the United States Supreme Court. Jeff, as we await the departure of the Anka, the former President George Bush, he's going to board that helicopter and head off eventually to Andrews Air Force Base and then Texas. What do you think? John Roberts had one job to do today, and he sort of screwed up.
Wolf, I almost fell out of my chair. You know, it's only a 35-word oath. It's actually much shorter than the Vice President's oath, and it's one of the most famous parts of the Constitution. But what Roberts did is he put the word faithfully, it's faithfully execute the office of president, but he said execute execute the office of president faithfully. And you saw Obama almost start to chuckle because he knew the oath and they got it together. But as you pointed out, he was already president by that point.
Hold on, Jeff. So. There's the shot. The president of the United States, Barack Obama, the former president of the United States, George W. Bush, they're walking down those stairs. He's escorting the former president to that Marine Corps helicopter that will be taking him off, taking him over to Andrews Air Force Base. The Bushes have gone. They're gone from the White House, Anderson. No more stuff there. They're packed up. They're out of there, and they're moving back to Texas.
Back to the movie set, because, of course, they're carpet-bagging Nazis from Kennebunkport, Maine. But my man Alex in Germany, of course, posted up, yeah, the Bushes are gone. But the first posting he got from WhiteHouse.gov as their new agenda in the defense section, quotes, extend global power, harden U.S. satellites against attack, win hearts and minds. Actual quotes from WhiteHouse.gov on the defense tab. Sounds nice. Sounds like big change. There's a nice op-ed from Christopher Ketchum that's over on counterpunch.org, and now I'm running short on time, and I'm not going to have time to read through it. It's basically the inauguration ad nauseum, as he watches the dog and pony show that, of course, is paid for by you and I, for the most part, of course, funded by Wall Street and the corporate elite. Oh, happy day. Thus doth change descend among us in the same old purple raiment and with smiling largesse that the peons pay for. January 20th is a historic wasted opportunity. Enough said. See you on day one when the work begins. Christopher Ketchum, inauguration ad nauseam. Which brings us to Obama's first day, second oath, and the Third World War. Obama's Day 1, Recession, War, Ethics, and More from the Associated Press in a first-day whirlwind. President Obama showcased efforts to revive the economy and summon top military officials to the White House to chart a new course in Iraq. What an opportunity we have to change this country. He, of course, on the good side, and there are good notes, and we will cover those new ethics rules for his administration. Fairly cosmetic, if you ask me. Obama gets to work with whirlwind first day and second oath. That's from the DPA. But from Kurt Nemo, day one for the global savior Obama, now that Obama's installed in the Oval Office, the job of saving the world can begin. Of course, that's what the corporate media tells us. This one-term senator, basically a man out of nowhere, will save us. In fact, Barack Obama cannot save us, and that will not be his job, even though millions apparently believe it. Obama's a front man for the NWO. He's a used car salesman tasked with selling us on global fascism, that is to say, transnational corporatism. As Obama wrote for the Globalist Council on Foreign Relations periodical Foreign Affairs, the security and well-being of each and every American depend on the security and well-being of those who live beyond our borders. For the globalists, security and well-being translates into invading small and enfeebled countries like Iraq and Afghanistan in order for the global elite to be secure, that is to say, for them to retain power and push their world domination agenda forward. Small nations resisting globalization must be invaded and carpet bombed with depleted uranium or white phosphorus. However, the next clip comes up, this time, of course, from Fox and Chris Wallace, doubting that Obama's even president because of the bungled oath.
And I will tell you, I asked these folks how they felt about the Chief Justice flubbing the oath a little bit, which for me, as somebody who covered the Supreme Court, was a bit of a surprise. They felt the way I felt, which was, it's nice to see that even the Chief Justice of the United States and our new president can get a little nervous in the big days.
Chris? You know, Megan, I have to say, I'm not sure that Barack Obama really is the president of the United States, because the oath of office is set in the Constitution. And I wasn't at all convinced that even after he tried to amend it, that John Roberts ever got it out straight and that Barack Obama ever said the prescribed words. I suspect that everybody is going to forgive him and allow him to take over as president. But I'm not sure he actually said what's in the Constitution there.
Chris, if it ever got to the Supreme Court, you have to know that there'd be at least one vote
that's
in favor
right.
of
that's
understand.
True. Britt is saying, Megan, that at the Supreme Court, that John Roberts will definitely vote that, yes, he has taken the proper oath of office.
That's a very good point. That sounds like a case for Kelly's court. Listen, before I toss it back to you, Chris.
Are you prepared to take the oath, Senator?
I am.
I, Barack Hussein Obama,
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
faithfully the office of President of the United States faithfully. And will to the best of my ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Well, again, we're wondering here whether or not Barack Obama, in fact, is the president of the United States. They had a kind of garbled oath. It's just conceivable that that this will end up going to the courts. But as Britt Hume rightly pointed out, if it goes to the Supreme Court, certainly Chief Justice Roberts will say that he took the oath. But that was a somewhat garbled moment on what was really a flawless day. Here's the picture of another swearing-in ceremony that they did, yesterday? They did this yesterday.
That's right.
To swear him in. You see this picture. I don't know if you guys have seen this picture or if you can where you're at.
I have.
Do you notice anything unusual about this picture?
There's no Bible.
There's no Bible. I've checked. We have never had president sworn into office without a Bible. Was there no one on the staff that said, hey, we better get a Bible because there's going to be a picture taken? Is there no Bible in the White House? Does this bother or just make anybody go, wow, that's a first?
No, it's not, Glenn Beck. There's more research to be done. So wrong as though those guys are, of course, again, if this becomes the great conspiracy, is he a citizen? Did they do the inauguration? Did they do the oath right? Wrong questions, they don't have to care about the answers. However, it is interesting, and there's lots of historical notes to be taken from the Washington Post and thinkprogress.org. No Bible used in Obama's second oath. And as I run out of time, I know there's no way I can... It's as I was researching this and posting all this stuff up, bizarre media synchronicities as far as The Simpsons and Futurama and Bibles and presidential oaths and Chester A. Arthur. Look up Chester A. Arthur. But don't get Chester A. arthritis. Obama offers internationalist vision. That's from IPSnews.net. Security team could use presidential doubles. That's from The Telegraph. Security experts said doubles could be used for public photo opportunities where Obama's not required to speak but may be exposed to a potential threat. Obama's understood to be against the idea of using doubles of himself because the tactic, you know, is generally associated with Hussein, Kim Jong-il, Stalin, and Hitler. But following hundreds of threats to his life, already some of those charged with protecting him believe it may become an option. However, the best-known Obama lookalike so far said he doesn't want the job. Iham Anas, 34, an Indonesian photographer who bears a striking resemblance to the president, said, I don't want to get shot. Inaugural prayer slam prompts Obama smile. WorldNet Daily and the strange questions about whoever that preacher was who gave that prayer, and it says something about white embracing what's right. Again, race card, division, divisive politics. It happens from both sides. Don't get stuck in it. U.S. Senate confirms Clinton as Secretary of State. That's from Wiki News. Of course, everybody's all together, back, big, happy family. Of course, conflict of interest with Billy Boy Clinton and his foundation. But conflict of interest never stopped the war party. Obama appoints top-notch CFR and Bilderberg members, more of them. Senate committee approves Timothy Geithner as Treasury Chief. This from the International Herald Tribune. You know, the guy who hasn't paid taxes and who hires illegals as his housekeepers. The guy who's been in the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. He didn't pay taxes. But of course, they approved him. Again, conflict of interest holds no water here. This emperor has no clothes. It will all end in tears. A blog from Gerald Warner over on thetelegraph.co.uk, but from Paul Joseph Watson, Obama's Nightmare Green agenda officially unveiled. Of course, implementing cap-and-trade program, cut carbon dioxide emissions by 80%, and sink the battered U.S. economy into a new Great Depression is now officially announced on whitehouse.gov. According to the outline for the Obama-Biden Comprehensive New Energy Plan for America plan...
plan isn't in there twice. I messed up. New Energy for America plan. The administration will, quote, implement an economy-wide cap-and-trade program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 80% by 2050. The proposal has its roots in the defeated 2007 Lieberman-Warner bill, America's Climate Security Act, link, 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 which proposed a cap-and-trade system to reduce carbon emissions 70% by 2050. If such a program were to be fully implemented, the consequences for the American economy would be devastating. The 2007 bill was rejected for good reason. Its passage would have created economic conditions comparable to New Great Depression and sunk America to near third world status. Link, link, link. Obama inauguration got 35 times the coverage of Bush. That's from Reuters. 35,000 more stories. Obama, of course, sides with Bush in the spy case. We hit this before. Here's the update from Threat Level. Obama administration fell in line with the Bush administration when it urged a federal judge to set aside a ruling in a closely watched spy case weighing whether a U.S. president may bypass Congress and establish a program of eavesdropping on Americans without warrants. PDF links and downloads. But of course, it's not all completely terrible, and now that I'm running low on time, I'm going to have to gloss over the good things. And that's unfortunate. I will pay more attention to the positive movements. Obama orders Guantanamo's closure within a year. That's, of course, from Washington Post. That's, of course, we'll see how that all works out. Caroline Kennedy withdraws from the New York Senate. The New York Post says a source said she never had a chance. If we glance at the news, Gillibrand, Kirsten E. Gillibrand, the two-term Democratic congresswoman chosen to fill the Senate seat vacated by Hillary Rodham Clinton, is now going to be the New York senator, appointed by Governor Patterson of New York, who was, of course, appointed after Elliot Spitzer wrote about predatory lending practices in the banksters, and he had to go. Obama frees Bush historical records. That's from Robert Perry and ConsortiumNews.com. Ordering the closure of the CIA secret prisons. Cryptogon notes, and again, as we will have to do, give credit where credit is due, opening up records from the Bush administration, trying to close Guantanamo, trying to close CIA secret prisons, but we got to read the fine print. From the Washington Post, many Bush officials held over at Homeland Stupidity. Of course, we're keeping Robert Gates, we're keeping lots of DHS officials. Existentialist Cowboy asks and tells you why Obama must insist on the prosecution of Bush for capital crimes, and we'll see if that happens, kids. Obama's orders leave torture and indefinite detention intact. That's the last and most recent update I have on the new administration of hope and change and continuity. That's from Global Research. It's basically an article about reading the fine print on all the fancy headlines that we're hearing from the new savior and his criminal cabinet. We're going to have to read the fine print. And that's all for the Obamasiah coronation. I definitely am glad it all went off without a hitch. You just bracing yourself. That's been the whole kind of catch. And that's somehow the almost effective threat-aganda from all of these guys is always been waiting for the other shoe to drop on the 9/11. I would have thought Bush and the boys would have rolled out Bin Laden's corpse on the day before the inauguration. It would have been perfect. That date was also January 19th, 119, or 911 backwards. Little numerology for you. I was hoping they'd roll out Bin Laden, then Bush sails off into the sunset. However, it's not all roses. And so, with all eyes on the inaugural Bread and Circus, this little buzzkill sneaks in and reminds us that politicians will almost always lie if they think they can get away with it. Returning to Portland, Oregon, and the mayor of Portland, Oregon, Sam Adams, reeling from a sex scandal. This from our own Oregonian, Portland Mayor Sam Adams, This is jumping back a few days as this controversy bubbles. And again, when you're in the middle of it, I'm not sure how national this story is. Portland Mayor Sam Adams made a public statement in a press conference. We're going to hear a moment from that. In response to news reports that he had a sexual relationship with an 18-year-old in the summer of 2005 and on the eve of his campaign for the city's highest office, lied about it and urged the young man to lie about it as well. The mayor's spokesman, of course, set the stage for Sam Adams' press conference. I should have been honest about what happened, but I was not.
I'm Angelica Thornton in the KQ newsroom. We want to briefly interrupt the inauguration events, which are running behind schedule. You'll continue to see them on your screen as we bring you breaking news from Portland City Hall,
everybody.
Where Mayor Sam Adams is issuing a public apology after lying about having a sexual relationship with a teenage intern.
What's his yesterday name? To individual news outlets. I want to reiterate my acknowledgement of mistakes that I've made, and I want to apologize to Portlanders for those mistakes. In the past, I characterized my relationship with Bo Breedlove as one being purely non-sexual, and that's not true. Bo Breedlove and I had a sexual relationship for a few months in the summer of 2005, after he turned 18 years of age. I lied at the time. Until yesterday, with the exception of Bo, I have not discussed with anyone the true nature of my relationship with him, not with my colleagues, not with my boyfriend, family. Because of my elected position in the community and because of the difference of our age, I also want to acknowledge that it was inappropriate for me to have a sexual relationship with an 18-year-old, and I want to apologize to the community for having done so. And I want to apologize to the people of Portland for my dishonesty and for embarrassing them. As one of the leaders of the gay community, I also want to apologize to the gay community for embarrassing them. I should have been truthful from the very beginning. So, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mayor, why do you believe that you did not have sex with this person before he turned 18?
That's not you described to us a meeting you had with Bo Breedlove prior to his 18th birthday, where you talked to him about an intimate relationship that said it wouldn't be appropriate until after his 18th birthday, but yet you admitted you had these conversations with a 17-year-old. Was that appropriate?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Last night, you were 18 years old.
Lunch at Marconi Grill.
Alone would be inappropriate.
That I aired the relationship after he became 18 did become sexual.
Mayor, did you lie about anything else during your campaign for mayor?
No, not that I'm aware of.
What about Bo Breedlove's parents, Mayor? You know, we've got a 42-year-old man, a 44-year-old man, trying to date their kid. He was 17, he went to his party, and before he was 18, he was 18 and he was betting.
Before he's 18?
No, he's 18. You're in bed.
Well, this was a consensual relationship, but again, I don't think it's appropriate. I don't think it was appropriate for me to have that relationship.
You heard it. I don't think it was appropriate. That's from Sam Adams. That's from the currently embattled mayor of Portland, Oregon. And that's just a little clip. So again, I mentioned I have a fuzzy TV channel that I was watching the inauguration on, as I had other media playing and was blogging and posting and writing and listening and watching. And I looked at some point and they went into split screen and I saw, Sam Adams is doing a press conference. Late the night before, on the 19th, the story had broke that Adams had finally said, yes, I lied about the relationship during the campaign. And by the next day, he was in D.C. attending a mayoral conference and, of course, the inauguration, but, of course, had to give a press conference. That whole press conference is up on YouTube, links for you there. However, the last update I have posted up before we look at Google News real quick, again from the Oregonian, Adams stays home as support crumbles. Mayor Sam Adams holed up in his North Portland house Wednesday, making phone calls and apologizing, but every sign from eroding support among gay and lesbian leaders to the deafening silence from Adams' political mentors to his own tone of voice signaled resignation. I've been involved in Oregon politics for a long time, and I obviously understand people's anger and frustration, Adams said Wednesday. His somber tone was striking in contrast to the firm determination to stay in office he expressed earlier in the week. On Wednesday, the Oregonian, the Portland Tribune, the Portland Business Journal, and Just Out, a Portland-based news magazine covering gay and lesbians, all called for his resignation. That last publication may not be a household name to many Oregonians, but its condemnation is a particularly bitter and significant blow for Adams, the first openly gay mayor of a top 40 U.S. city. Now, in the press conference clip, we heard him say, "I'll be happy to take your questions," but of course he's visibly shaking and not really happy to take questions. And, of course, the sidebar mention is the other bigger problem in history of sex scandals in Oregon. So, Sam Adams, Neil Goldschmidt, and, of course, Bob Packwood. I've only lived in Portland for a few years, so I did not experience those other ones. However, as we're covering the seemingly inevitable fall of Sam Adams, mayor of Portland, Oregon, we're going to be covering this story more. As we wrap up this episode 108, let's glance at Google News and look at the latest on Sam Adams. Adams should resign. That's from bizjournals.com. In last week's Business Pulse survey, majority of the respondents said Portland Mayor Sam Adams should resign. There's also videos and articles from the Associated Press. Should Portland Mayor resign over teen sex lie? Sex scandal divides Portland and its gay community. Adams embattled Portland Mayor. And of course, the Attorney General is going to investigate. And alliances are forming and allies are coming forward and lines are probably being drawn. Guys like Lars Larson on the radio call and wait for his resignation. But we'll see. For me, coming to you from Portland, Oregon, every week here, Portland Radio Authority, Revere Radio Network, MediaMonarchy.com. It was an interesting intersection between the inaugural and between that and literally interrupting the parade with my mayor reeling from allegations of a teen sex scandal. It's kind of ugly. Fortunately, yesterday we went to go see Frost Nixon. It was excellent. The Nixon investigation is always an interesting one. Of course, I told you about Secret Honor a few weeks ago. But that's going to do it. Too much. Like I said, can't do it all justice. I do my best. I try. I put it out there for you. I love you. Thanks for listening to it. Creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. It's a short but interesting one. The Israel Electric Company, they're reading about Police State International, Miltech, Mad Science, Danger Training, and Tasers, which we went over on last night's B-side of 107. The Henan Finance College in Henan, China, they Googled Merchants Association Marketing Director called festivities for the sickening feeling left by the shootings at Westroads Mall on Wednesday. FEMA out of Springfield, Missouri, reading about World of Warcraft, Weather Wars, HARP, Mind Control, and Lasers. Cowan & Company, consulting firm out of New York City, they Googled Gerald Celente, Halliburton Retention Revolution. We, of course, have the military, monmouth.army.mil, headquarters USAISC out of Fort Huachuca, Arizona. They're reading about Obama-sized inaugural emergencies in the end of the beginning from last week, and of course the declaration of a state of emergency. Cantor Fitzgerald and Company out of New York. And again, go to 8thestate.com and Richard Andrew Grove and 911synchronicity.com to read more about Cantor Fitzgerald, Skadden Arps, Martian McLennan, Kroll Associates, and all the dirty money laundering and connection and insurance and 9/11. Super 8 in Jackson, Mississippi. Somebody Googled Ron Paul, South Carolina debate 2008 and came to MediaMonarchy.com. The Tennessee Valley Authority, who of course were responsible for the hundreds of millions of tons of, or rather gallons of ash and sludge in Tennessee recently, Somebody at the TVA Googled suspicious envelopes from Knoxville force evacuation at the Wall Street Journal. And they did. Commission of the European Communities in the UK reading about Israeli slaughter, false flags, ceasefires, and other lies. Again, we went over that last night on 107B. And finishing it off, again, Fort Lewis. Lewis.army.mil. They were reading, digging deep on MediaMonarchy.com. Back a couple years, U.S. military urged to revise its tarnished brand. And of course, with their new front man, they will set to doing just that. I can't put it all into perspective. I maybe need a little hindsight. I've been stewing on all of this for far too long. It's been perhaps an overwhelming focus of Media Monarchy. Perhaps we'll wean ourselves away from that. But like Saul Williams said at the beginning, we are the government. We are the law. And he's right. So my friends, like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.